Kunsthaus Zürich. Welcome to this podcast linked to the exhibition Earth Beats, the Changing Face of Nature, created by Sandra Gianfreda and Katrin Hug. In 12 episodes, you will hear, among others, ecofeminists, writers, glaciologists, fashion designers and economists who take us right into the middle of a highly topical debate about climate and the environment. My name is Katrin Hug, and in this episode I'm talking with TJ Demos. He is the founder of the Center for Creative Ecologies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and professor in the Department of History of Art and Visual Culture. He is the author of numerous books, including Beyond the World's End, Arts of Living and the Crossing, published in 2020, and Decolonizing Nature, published in 2016. I wanted to ask you, is there a specific moment in your biography where you thought, now I really have to really go deep into the questions of and commitment to environmental questions and reflection and so on?
Sure. Well, there are several moments in terms of that transition in my work. And I was already working as an art historian and a critic in around 2005. I had finished my PhD in 2000 and was already investigating, really looking closely at contemporary art in relationship to globalization and its many crises, including migration, militarism, and the conditions of advanced capitalism. And I, in 2005, I ended up taking a job in London and moving to London in the summer of 2005. And that August was the occasion of Hurricane Katrina in the States, which hit New Orleans in a very catastrophic way. And this became, you know, I followed this very closely because I had just left and was living in London. But I was looking back at what was happening in the States. This was in the context of the George W. Bush presidency. It was clear that in many ways, globalization as a triumphalist discourse that was celebrating a post-Cold War borderless world was in some ways breaking up. And Katrina showed that it was also coming up against its environmental limits in terms of what capitalism's transformation of the environment and Earth's natural systems would entail. And this was just a catastrophic event. It caused massive flooding and a loss of lives. Nearly 2,000 people died. It was also a social and political catastrophe as well. And I learned lots of things out of that event that continued to occupy me in terms of the significance of climate catastrophe and how it's already happening in our present, especially with these extreme weather events. And then what I've been calling recently socio-environmentalism, the need to think ecology together with the social and political, was clear in that event, especially insofar as it negatively impacted African-American populations in the States, in Louisiana and New Orleans. So people who were impoverished, who were suffering already from forms of structural racism, were profoundly impacted. So this was an event of capitalist disaster, I think, and it had a real moving, profound effect on me. And I knew that for someone like myself, who is interested in looking toward contemporary art as an arena where some of the most meaningful and urgent issues can be addressed and creatively thought about and considered in an interdisciplinary experimental framework, it was clear that that what was happening ecologically or in relationship to climate breakdown was something that could no longer be ignored. So it wasn't a question at that point to do something else that would be more directly responsive to climate transformation. I thought, you know, what I can do is address it in my work, and to look to see how artists had been addressing it already by 2005 for decades, going back to the 60s. And we're continuing to do so in all sorts of ways that art history as a discipline hadn't yet come to terms with at all, to put it lightly. Some curators had, were beginning to, and artists had long been doing so, but I thought that's a way to approach this and to integrate it into my practice, is to, you know, to consider creative and critical responses to climate breakdown. And that began gradually. A few years, I began thinking about it, and within a few years, I had the opportunity to contribute a catalog essay to an exhibition in London at the Barbican called Radical Nature. And this was a great invitation because I had a lot of flexibility and could write about whatever I wanted. And I chose to address this category of sustainability, which is an incredibly complex and conflictual and even contradictory category within climate politics. And that proved to be really enabling for me, and was an entrance into shifting my practice more and more in that direction. And I think looking back on it from today, it was the right move.
Yeah, especially speaking of the notion you were just mentioned, sustainability, which is independence of if it's used in an economic sense or in an ecological sense, it can be also completely contradictory. Was then this time when you founded your institute, the Creative Ecologies Institute in Santa Cruz?
Yeah, the Center for Creative Ecologies was something I created in 2015. And this is when I moved back to the States, to University of California in Santa Cruz. And I had the opportunity at that moment to propose and get some seed funding to set up this center. And part of the motivation to do this was to try to think of how to contribute to the institutionalization of an academic and interdisciplinary research project that could advance the study of this conjuncture of visual culture, contemporary art, ecology, and radical politics. Because I wasn't seeing that this really existed anywhere. There was nothing comparable like this. Maybe, you know, the project Research Architecture at Goldsmiths in London, you know, that was an inspiration for me. But this was not in the field of art history and visual culture per se. So that was something that I thought I could contribute and to build in Santa Cruz, which had so many resources in terms of speculative and critical thinkers, people like Donna Haraway and Anit Singh and Karen Barad, who are doing so much in relationship to feminist science studies and environmental theories and approaches to also indigenous ecologies. And so Santa Cruz became a really welcoming place to set up this kind of center that could pursue, you know, real meaningful interdisciplinary studies, also between academic research and practice-based research, and could also move out and form bridges to community organizations and NGOs and activist groups. And I was interested in that. So the Center for Creative Ecologies, in some ways, I was thinking about creativity, not just in relationship to artistic practice, but how we might, you know, institute otherwise to create a different kind of place for academic and community-based research that was not limited to the university, that wasn't determined by its relatively strict disciplinary boundaries, and could open up pathways for new ways of thinking, and ultimately could encourage creative ways of living otherwise.
By creative, do you mean that it's especially independent of fundings? Can we say that by saying creative, you mean also that you want to take out the fear of being dependent of fundings and the output of the researchers, that it's much more dynamic and also experimental?
Yes, but in some ways I wish we weren't so independent of funding, if you know what I mean. You know, like we could use more funding. But the Center for Creative Ecologies is quite modest. It's doing a lot of really interesting work because of the people involved in it are inspirational and energetic and are able to just do a lot. And we can operate with very little budget. And, you know, we have a high degree of autonomy in terms of what we can do, what kind of questions we can ask, who we can invite to speak. So it hasn't really been such a problem in terms of that issue of, say, the co-optation or instrumentalization of creativity.
More in depth also about the notion of decolonizing nature, and was very fascinated that you applied this decolonization on nature. I was wondering if you could bring a little bit closer to our listeners what you mean by this decolonization of nature.
Sure. So Decolonizing Nature is the name of a book that I published in 2016, and I had been working on it for several years. One of the ambitions of that text was to investigate how contemporary artists were dealing with different aspects of ecology and environmental thinking, and to do so within more of a global expansiveness than simply focusing on, say, the global north within the European context or the North American one. And as I was doing that research, I was also coming across, not surprisingly, a lot of politics around extractivism and multinational corporations in terms of their negative impacts on the lands and waters and atmospheres of different geographies on the earth. And that's the kind of the threat of climate disaster that we're facing now. We know that it's really driven by the current advanced economy and its economic arrangements and what it does in terms of exploitation and extraction of value from lands. And worldwide, there are also movements of resistance against this. Many of them are grounded within indigenous struggles against a long history of colonization. And that entered into my radar as a really important history and formation to take note of and to really integrate strongly, increasingly so, in my research. And, you know, once you get involved in that, you see the centrality of this term decolonization to an indigenous environmental movement that's transnational and is attempting to reverse and take back some of the conditions that have been completely, you know, threatened and abused by colonial capital. So decolonization basically means the return of land and sovereignty to indigenous peoples who are continuing to live under the conditions of extractive colonial capitalism. So for me, this was part of a compelling argument to develop in relationship to an environmental politics that we can't really think about addressing environmental reparation unless we're also thinking about decolonization ultimately. So in that book, I was trying to think about decolonization and develop it in ways that that go beyond that initial radical demand of returning land and sovereignty to indigenous peoples. I was interested in the cultural questions, more of the complex conceptual aspects of this. How was nature being colonized, in other words? Well, I was looking at, for instance, all sorts of things, extractive projects, the way landscapes or mountains or rivers are turned into sources of economic value by corporations with little care for biodiverse sustainability, or within the agricultural industries, how plant species are being basically owned and subjected to intellectual property regimes according to biogenetic capitalism, or how industry in general tends to socialize debt even though they're privatizing profits in the interests of the few rather than the needs of the many. And so this is a kind of colonization of nature where capitalist industries are treating the world and its resources as if they own it and can do whatever they want with it, outside of all democratic accountability and politics of regulation. And so this is, I think, the center of the conflict. And if we're going to ever hope to create a world of environmental well-being and health for all, including not just humans, but the more than human web of life, we're going to have to enact a radical transformation of these conditions. And for me, this comes under the name decolonization.
When speaking about looking for solutions, the mobility of cars that go from carbon to electricity, there is the new problem that these batteries, again, need also these different metals from very specific regions. And again, of course, the problem of fossils is maybe solved a little bit, is a bit better, but then new problems come. I wanted you to comment a little bit on this, a little bit double game, like, or hypocrisies on from some corporations also.
Yeah, exactly. We're in the middle of a energy paradigm shift, where we're moving toward electrification. And that's requiring, as you're pointing out, massive extraction of these new metals and rare earths, like lithium, that not surprisingly come from places like the Congo or from Bolivia, areas that, again, are and have a relation to indigenous sovereignty and are creating these situations of conflict over resources, or what some call resource wars, new resource wars that are changing political arrangements and encouraging forms of anti-democratic dictatorial arrangements, like what had happened in Bolivia in the last couple of years, although that was recently reversed in the Bolivian elections. But Bolivia has enormous lithium reserves, and that's necessary to make the batteries for electric cars and for computer and all sorts of IT technology. Yeah, this solution ends up not being a solution at all, because it ends up, it's a way of denying the need to confront this kind of this advanced and consumerist way of life that is simply not sustainable. And so instead of asking how can we change our systems, we're basically creating ever new false solutions or techno fixes to seem like things are being fixed, but actually they're creating, as you're saying, they're creating new sources of problems. So we're, in other words, we're creating new sets of problems as we try to address the challenges of decarbonization. But the one thing we're not addressing is the most, you know, radical proposal, which is simply degrowth. You know, how can we stop the endless production of things and attempt as a society to live in a way that has a lighter touch, that isn't endlessly consuming unnecessary things? But that ecological principle of degrowth comes up against the capitalist demand for endless growth. And that's the fundamental contradiction of what we're living with today, which is ultimately an environmental capitalist conflict.
In terms of a particular sector, which is one you are very close to, is the tech sector in California, and digitalization is so much hope is put into that part of the problem can be solved like that. And I'm sure you observe this, of course, as well. And are there solution proposals there, and which one? And also maybe how do you feel about this?
Well, I'm immediately suspicious because of the dangers of what we can call green capitalism. And that is when protagonists within the economic and political elites, like Bill Gates, take on and recognize the imperatives of addressing climate breakdown. They're doing so within the framework where there's absolutely no questioning of the dominant economic systems. So the ambition for them is to how to think about and formulate climate solutions within the context of capitalism. And I, for one, and lots of other people, just think that that itself is an impossibility, ultimately. That if you understand the framework and the internal logic of that economic system, we realize that there's simply no way that it can ever escape from its dominant fundamental imperative, which is to endlessly grow and to place near-term profits above all other considerations. Nonetheless, Bill Gates and others in the tech industry are indeed proposing solutions that are, not surprisingly, fundamentally technocratic solutions. How can we use technology as a way to fix the problems that this economic system has produced in relationship to environmental breakdown? And one of the key areas of research is what's called geoengineering. How can we engineer a new world by shifting the way that we interact with Earth's natural systems? So geoengineering falls under two categories: solar radiation management and carbon capture technologies. And these are a little bit like pipe dreams. They're proposed as ways to fix things, but again, it's another desperate attempt to get around considering how we can actually determine as a society to live in a way that's more sustainable. Rather, these are ways to allow and enable the current way of life and all of its consumerism and negative carbon impacts to just continue infinitely into the future without changing anything, because that is somehow understood to be politically impossible at the present moment.
I hear between the lines that grassroots politics, grassroots initiatives can be one solution. So if there's a simple recommendation to our audiences, our listeners, what would we recommend them?
Well, I think this is a crucial question. And the main challenge here is how we can think and act beyond ethical individualism. So it's not a matter of personal responsibility or individual ethics, whether embracing recycling or limiting our carbon impact or buying an electric car or installing solar panels, because ultimately that's not going to bring about the structural transformation that we need, the large-scale, globalized transformation that. And it's only that where we'll see the possibility of avoiding this catastrophic future. So I think really there's an emerging, forceful, ethical and political imperative these days to become involved with social movements and to collectivize so that we can put the pressure that's necessary to take back politics from economic corruption and corporate domination. Really, that's the only thing we can do. I'm interested in thinking about this, tracing it, and involving myself in it, both as an activist, as a member of organizations that are not just also environmentalist in the narrow sense of the term, but are also making political demands, and specifically anti-capitalist, in reinventing the possibilities of an anti-capitalist socialism. So for me, that would be in the States, in the context of the States, the Democratic Socialists of America. We have to fundamentally reinvent our conditions of politics. And you know, I think this is what everyone needs to address and think about, that ethical-political imperative. In their own life, in their own circumstances, wherever they are. And I'm also interested in, again, to take this back to artistic practice, to seeing how artists are doing this as well, in an expanded sense of what artistic practice can be today, which is collectivized and, in many cases, aligned with social movements. And that includes, like, activist formations, where we wouldn't say that they're artistic per se, but they definitely involve all sorts of interesting creative aesthetic elements, whether that's the Ende Gelände attempts to shut down lignite mining in Germany, or Liberate Tate, that has attempted to challenge toxic philanthropy from museums in the UK, or the group Decolonize This Place in New York, that is part artistic, part a social movement that is also challenging these conditions of corporate toxicity within arts funding within the New York context, or whether it's indigenous movements like the No Dapple struggle in Standing Rock to challenge the development of fossil fuel infrastructure. These are all examples of struggles that are not simply or merely artistic, but are aesthetic within the larger sense of dealing with storytelling, images, and ways of living otherwise in a creative, according to a creative socio-environmental radical politics. And these are, for me, deeply inspirational. And I think in terms of what someone can do today, or the question, what can one person do? I think the immediate answer has to be stop being one person. We need to collectivize. We need to think and act with others. And it's only through doing that that we have any hope of taking back the political systems that have been so thoroughly dominated by fossil capital over the last decades, if not hundreds of years. And this is what we're up against. If we don't do that, I don't think there's any hope for a narrowly conceived environmental activism. Environmentalism cannot just be about decarbonization. It has to ultimately be about social justice and democratization.
Publisher, Zürcher Kunstgesellschaft, Kunsthaus Zürich, Idea and Conception, Sandra Gianfrieda and Katrin Hug, Editing and Production, Christoph Keller, Podcast Lab, Production of the Jingles, Markus Mäder. This podcast is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer and Audible. With many thanks to Rhiannon Ash, Esther Braun and Sarah Carla Nancy. With support of Swiss Re, partner of Contemporary Art, and Tabaka Indigo Foundation. For this episode, the artist Markus Mäder recorded the sounds of a summer meadow in South Bavaria with a grumbling blackbird.